Want more stories in your life without adding to your TBR? That's where Audible comes in. I use it for the original novellas, the Plus catalog like Deanna Reborn's Veronica Speedwell series, and those audiobook sales that you can beat. Right now, Audible has a special offer for new and returning members. Click the link in the show notes to see what deal you'll get and start listening today. Welcome to the What to Read Next podcast. In this podcast, your host, Lori Amin, will interview published authors to chat about their work, journey to getting published, and their book recommendations. If you share a passion for books and always looking for your next read, then join us. Hi, Jeff. Welcome to What to Read Next podcast.
Thanks for having me. Great to be here.
So happy to have you here. So tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, I'm a transplanted Midwesterner. I grew up in a town called Freeport, Illinois. Mm-hmm. And in my early 20s, I moved to New York for what I thought was a 3-month job. And that was 25 years ago. And I haven't left yet. So at this point, I might never leave. I've been career-wise, I've been in various ways a comedy writer for most of my life. I started out in the weird thing is I started out in the 90s and I wanted to be a political satirist. Mm-hmm. Because I grew up reading, like, P.G. O'Rourke was a columnist in Rolling Stone, who I really loved. Gary Trudeau, who did the Doonesbury cartoons, which were very political, was kind of an idol of mine. And that was the kind of humor I wanted to do. But after I spent a couple of years trying to make a living at it, I realized that's a business that there were only about 3 people in America who had that job. Mm-hmm. And anytime you're trying to get into an industry that consists of 3 people, your odds aren't really good. So I figured pretty quickly that I needed to do something slightly different. So I started writing screenplays, and I was a working screenwriter for about 10 or 12 years. I wrote, I think, somewhere around 25 screenplays, of which I think I got paid for maybe half of them. And 4 of them wound up getting made into movies. All of them were family films, which is weird because mostly what I wrote was not family films, but that's just what got made. And the most popular of those was probably an Eddie Murphy movie called Daddy Daycare.
Yeah.
And I also, I also wrote a Robin Williams movie called RV. I was one of a bunch of writers who did the Disney remake of The Shaggy Dog with Tim Allen. And so I did that for about 10 or 12 years, and then the movie business kind of started to change in ways that made me realize I either needed to move to Los Angeles and start writing for television or find another way to make a living. Mm-hmm. So I found another way to make a living because I'd been to Los Angeles and I did not want to live there. And that's when I started writing books. I initially, I was a comedy writer, so my kind of value added was things that were funny. And so I went to the bookstore and I looked around and I was like, well, where are the funny books? And mostly they were in the children's section. Mm-hmm. So I started, because I don't know what, there's something about, like, adults don't actually want humor. You know, they want their humor leavened, like they want their drama leavened with humor, but they don't necessarily want humor on its own. So, but kids seem to. And so I started writing kids' books for, like, middle grade kids, like, you know, like 10 to 12 year olds. I've written about 10 of those now. The most recent one I co-wrote with the actor Kevin Hart. And that just came out. And actually, I just found out yesterday it's on the New York Times bestseller list. So that's exciting.
Congratulations.
Thanks. And then the reason I'm here, which is Lights Out in Lincolnwood, is my first novel for adults.
So tell me about Lights Out in Lincolnwood. What is the elevator pitch?
So it's a family drama wrapped in a disaster story with a real strong sort of comedic sensibility, and it follows a family of 4 in a wealthy New Jersey suburb over the 3 days after the entire technological infrastructure of modern society suddenly collapses on a random Tuesday morning. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so the power grid goes down, you know, phones don't work, laptops, televisions, any car manufactured after about 1975, because they all have electric starters, everything that's got a circuit board just stops working. And in the context of the story, nobody can really figure out whether this is something that is permanent, in which case it's probably the collapse of civilization, or temporary, in which case it's just a big pain in the neck. And so the, you know, day one, things are reasonably, you know, amicable, that there's kind of a, we're all in this together quality to the community. But by day two, people are looting the Whole Foods. Day three, the neighbors form a militia, and just things get really weird. And so the family at the center of this, the Altmans, they're four people, two teenage kids and a mom and a dad, and they all have, they're all wrestling at the beginning of the story with various problems of greater and lesser importance. And where a lot of the comedy comes from is things like trying to figure out, like, at what point do you stop worrying about your kids, you know, college application essay and start worrying about where you're going to get clean drinking water. And the one exception to that is the mom in the family, Jen, who, when the story opens, has been wrestling with sort of like an increasingly serious, drinking problem that she's been able to mostly hide, partially hide from, at least she's been able to hide the severity of it from her family. And on this Tuesday morning, she's resolved that this is absolutely positively the day she quits drinking. And then the lights go out and that resolution gets tested in ways that are consequential to the plot.
So I gotta say,
that was a long elevator ride, wasn't it?
Elevator ride, but you know, it just reminded me, and you're a New Yorker, so you probably experienced Sandy.
That's exactly where this came from. We lost
Sandy, and I lived in New York, and so I experienced Sandy, and that's just like what happened, you know, like no power, like no trains, nothing was working.
Exactly. Where did you live?
Jersey City. I was stuck in Jersey City in the waterfront. So most of my stuff was in New York. So I used to take the path. Like I lived like water. Hudson River, here's
right,
my,
right.
You know, most of the stuff. So I was, and because I live in the same street as Goldman Sachs needed power. So they got power first.
They famously, their power came back first.
Yeah. So I live in the same street. So I got power, but pretty much everywhere else was either flooded or there was no power. So, right. And the trains were not working.
Yeah, and we had the additional problem of we're at the top of a 10-story building, and we lost not only power but water, because you know the water gets up to us through pumps, and the pumps with no electricity the pumps didn't work. We didn't have any backup, so I would have to we just got immediately reduced. We're on we're in Lower Manhattan. We're about 20 blocks from where the power was on. Mm-hmm. And we were very immediately reduced to just sort of like a hunter-gatherer lifestyle. Like we had three kids, and like every morning I would have to like haul buckets of water. The superintendent in the building had busted open a street hydrant and filled a giant like garbage bin full of water. And so every morning I would get like buckets of water and I'd carry them up 10 flights of stairs so we could flush the toilet. And then we'd march the kids after we dealt with that. We marched the kids up like 20 blocks to where the power was on. Mm. And then we find them sandwiches at a deli. And then we go to a friend's house and we shower and charge our phones. And then we had to get back downtown before the sunset because there were no lights in the streets. And then we would just, we go to bed at 7 o'clock because we didn't want to run out of our flashlight batteries. And it just got very, and that was where the Lincolnwood book came from, because ever since then I've had this feeling of like, I'm completely dependent on these complex systems for my basic human needs. And I never have to worry about my basic human needs because when I turn on the tap, there's always water. And when I go to the store, there's always food in the shelves. And the thought of like, if all this went away, what would I do was, I sort of had two choices once I was confronted with that, which was like either move upstate, buy land, dig a well and acquire some livestock and firearms, or write a book. And I wrote a book, which is probably a poorly adaptive, response, but that's what I did.
So it's all good. Yeah. My family live in Puerto Rico. So they experienced Maria, which is like the power grid was off for about 4 months. They did not have
that's
a generator. It was like water, like coming from different places. It's like natural disasters. So you don't realize how dependent you are until it's gone. And it's like the grid, like how important the grid is, So.
Yeah. And so that was, it's that kind of fear that's sort of the the issue at the heart of Lincolnwood.
Yeah.
But it's leavened with comedy.
Yes.
It's not just a horror story.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's look at the positive side of it, and you know how ridiculous it can be at the same time. So but thank you for reliving the memories of Sandy. I haven't thought about that in about almost 9 years or however long that's been.
Yeah, it was a thing. Yeah.
It was like, yeah, I was like, if you were there in New York during Sandy or during the blackout, like you just know, like, you know, that moment. It's like, you know, you're connected.
Yeah. Well, and the interesting thing, the family in the story, I had to, and actually everybody in the community in Lincolnwood, I had to accommodate, I had to account for the fact that, like, they all would have experienced Hurricane Sandy. Mm-hmm. So they actually would have made various, you know, they have stockpiles of water and food because of Hurricane Sandy. So it made it a little bit like, the situation is slightly less dire because everybody in the fictional story also went through that.
That's good. So I'm assuming you wrote some of this during the pandemic, so which is another disaster.
Believe it or not, I wrote the entire thing before the pandemic started.
Oh my God, that you're lucky.
Well, it's weird though, because it's turned into this like kind of current events bingo card. Like, yeah. You know, the pandemic happened and I was like, that's a little weird. And then there were, you know, when all the protests happened last summer, you know, my neighborhood got looted, which mm-hmm. is very similar to what happens in Lincolnwood. And then, you know, in January, there was the white guy militia insurrection in DC, which is very similar to what happens in the book. And then in February, the Texas water and power, you know, crisis happened, and everybody, it was like Jesus, everything in this book is kind of, and I'm just hoping like nothing else in the book comes true, because it can get a lot worse.
I hope so too. But yeah. Yeah.
But it was weird though. And I also, the funny thing I did do, I went through it, I revised it in the summer after the pandemic, and I came upon toward the end of the book, there's a line of interior monologue from one of the characters where they think to themselves, what are we going to do when we run out of toilet paper? And I wrote that 4 months before the global toilet paper shortage. And when I saw that, I was like, should I make more of that? And I was like, no, I'm just leave it alone and not try to, you know, not try to capitalize too much on the fact that it actually happened.
Oh my gosh. So you're like a prediction, like, you know.
It's creepy. It was pretty creepy.
Like, somehow you predicted, you know, the world was almost going to end, you know. So.
I did not want to. I would have rather that there not have been an apocalypse right before my book about a fictional apocalypse came out.
Yes.
I don't know. It actually might be really great timing. I don't know. It's still the jury is still out on whether that was really good or really bad timing.
So I got a question. What was the process of getting, you know, writing for adults, transitioning out of middle grade children's book to adult? Was it any easier, any harder to do break that ground, or?
It was, in some ways, it was easier to write the novel for adults. Mm-hmm. Because what's the thing, and I think, you know, Lights Out in Lincolnwood, it's going to be, I think, my 11th book. And it's as much as I love the ones that I did for kids, it's much closer to my heart than those are, because it's written for me. Like, mm-hmm. I'm the audience for that book. And, you know, when I write for kids, I've always tried to write for the 12-year-old in me, but I haven't been 12 in a really long time. So it's always like the process with writing the kids book is thinking, well what do I want to write? And then is a 12-year-old going to relate to that? When I write a draft of a kid's book, I'll frequently have to go back through it a second time and do a draft that's entirely like, let's take out the stuff that the 12-year-olds are just not going to react to. Except for the occasional thing that you sort of leave in for the parents in case they're reading out loud to their kids, which there aren't a lot of parents reading out loud to 12-year-olds, but you know, the book's aged down to the age where some people do that. But so it was weirdly easier writing for adults than it has been writing for kids.
That's scary. Well, I think it's obviously your own audience. So you probably want to, it's more easier to know, it's more
connected to yourself, as opposed to a kid when you have to think about what a 12-year-old thing, what, you know, what's current for them. It's a little different. Like, you have to work.
Yeah. So yeah, completely.
When you're writing for yourself, you're like, I would like this, you know, I'll read this, like, this is fine. So.
Well, and I also have, like, you know, I have the voice of a 50-year-old, mm-hmm. and you have to, you know, and if I'm writing for adults, I don't have to modulate it. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's actually weirdly easier for writing for adults. Although the thing that's interestingly more difficult is character backstories, because when you're writing about a 12-year-old kid, you only need to figure out the first 12 years of their life. Whereas if you're writing about a 50-year-old, especially if you're writing about a 50-year-old couple, which I was writing about in Lincolnwood, like, I needed to know what the last 50 years were like, and also what the 25 years of their marriage had been like. Like, so that's, you know, there's a lot of that sort of subterranean, you know, the writing that never appears on the page that you have to come up with in sort of establishing who these people are and what their lives have been like. So that's one respect in which it's a lot harder.
Yeah, I can imagine just thinking about, like, the baggage, the things that you need as a 50-year-old is very different than a 12-year-old. Like, the relationship with family, like, how you relate to the world, how you see the world is very different, you know. So.
And you've gone through a lot of life phases mm-hmm. by the time you get to middle age. And, yes. you know, if you want to write a psychologically believable character, you kind of have to figure out what their life phases were.
Mm-hmm.
So. Yes. But at the same time, it was a fun exercise. Like, there are a couple of extended moments. The couple in Lincolnwood are Dan and Jen, and each of them has sort of an extended chapter of kind of, you know, sort of think like what led them up to these moments in their life that were kind of a lot of fun to actually write.
I love this. So, what are you working next?
It's funny. I'm a little bit at a crossroads where the Kevin Hart book has a sequel, and I just turned in the sequel. The first Kevin Hart book was called Marcus Makes a Movie. It's about a kid who makes a superhero movie with his friends. With, you know, they don't know what they're doing. They have no budget. They have no anything. You know, yeah. they make a superhero movie. And at the end of that book, the movie they make, they put it on YouTube and it goes viral. Mm-hmm. So book two is called Marcus Makes It Big, and it's about sort of both the good and the occasionally really bad things that can happen when you get that level of, like, sort of instant viral attention on the internet. And then that's finished. And I'm now sort of, with about maybe doing a television adaptation of that. Also possibly a film adaptation of Lights Out in Lincolnwood. And then beyond that, I kind of have to decide. Like, I have one more idea for a kid's book that I really want to do. But then I think I might be kind of done with kids' books, and I want to write another novel for adults, because it was so much fun writing Lincolnwood. But I'm not 100% sure what it would be yet.
That's all good.
Things take a while.
It takes a while, and it takes a while to gestate, you know, the idea and to come up with it and try it stuff. But you have, your plate is full with, like, multiple projects.
Well, it was full. It's a little empty right now. Unless the TV and film things come to fruition. It's, yeah.
Yeah.
It's one of those. That's the, I was just listening to a podcast that they were interviewing this, I can't remember the name of the actor, but he was a Tony Award winner, and he gave this Tony acceptance speech. And one of the things he said was, like, you should always remember at the top of every mountain is the bottom of another mountain.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what writing books is like. It's like, you know, whenever I'm writing a book, I'm like, I can't wait until this is done,
mm-hmm.
which is the dumbest thing on earth, because once the book is done, then I have to figure out what the next thing is going to be. And that's actually really hard. So it's easier to be in the middle of writing a book than it is at the beginning of one and trying to figure out what it's going to be. So.
Well, best of luck, whatever comes up. But I'm so glad that you have a New York Times bestseller book. You know, you have an adult debut coming out this summer, and you have already finished the next book. So you're way ahead of yourself. So,
well, thanks.
Awesome. So what has been a book that you have read over the past year that you can't stop crushing about that you recommend our listeners to pick up?
So in terms of fiction, Ayad Akhtar's Homeland Elegies, which I picked up, I took my first post-pandemic trip. I went and visited my mother who lives in Oregon now. And, you know, I brought that book on the plane and I just couldn't put it down. It was so good. And it's this weird amalgam of, it's shelved under fiction and there are elements of it that are nonfiction. And it's, you know, it's about the main character is Ayad Akhtar. It's fantastic. I couldn't recommend it more. And then the other one, which I read a couple of years ago, and I keep bringing up to people because it had a real influence on my thinking, was a book called Behave by a scientist named Robert Sapolsky, who is mostly a primatologist. Like he studies apes, and he sort of breaks down the sources of human behavior. From literally the way your neurons fire in your brain, all the way up to, you know, the influence of hundreds of millions of years of evolution on us. And it was just, as a writer, it was this really fascinating insight into all the facets of like what makes people do what they do. And there was a lot in it about sort of the way that our brains are almost wired for tribalism in a way. A lot also about the really huge impact that early childhood has on your personality and your behavior, you know, well into adulthood. So that was really, especially if you're a writer, I think it's a fascinating book that I just keep coming back to.
I love this. Tell us where you can find you online.
Twitter and Instagram at Jeff Rodkey, and the books I would like to think are available wherever fine books are sold. Mm-hmm. You know, if you put Lights Out in Lincolnwood into the search bar, it should come up at most bookstores, and also hopefully at most in-person bookstores.
Yeah,
fingers crossed.
That is very true. Thank you, Jeff, for being on the show.
Thanks for having me. This was great.
If you enjoyed this podcast, feel free to share it with friends, subscribe, rate, and review the show. This is the easiest way to support the podcast. For book recommendations, author interview archives, and other fun book resources and tips, please visit whatyourenextblog.com. The What You Read Next podcast is part of the Frolic Network. To discover new shows to listen and love, please visit frolic.media/podcast. Thank you so much for listening and have a great day.
Are you an author, publisher, or book-related business looking to reach passionate readers? What You Read Next podcast is a perfect place to connect with an engaged audience of romance and mystery lovers who are always on the hunt for their next great read. Now, we're offering sponsorship opportunities. Whether you're launching a new book, promoting an upcoming release, showcasing a bookish product or services, we can help you get the word out. Let's work together to bring your books or businesses to readers who are ready to discover something new. Please visit whatyourreadnextblog.com/sponsorships. To learn more or reach out to chat about the perfect sponsorship or package for you. Thank you so much for listening. Your next great reader is waiting for you.